Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and I'll be your guide today. We're diving into an really extraordinary stack of sources here. They detail a period of just intense chaos and, frankly, contradiction within American governance. Our mission is to give you an exhaustive, granular deep dive into the 48 hours that kicked off on Sunday, November 9th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. It's good to be digging into this because when historians look back at what was the longest U.S. government shutdown, I mean, we're talking 41 days by this point.
41 agonizing days.
Exactly. This specific period, November 9th and 10th, which is covered in these sources titled The Federal News Update for Monday, November 10th, 2025, it really stands out. It feels like the ultimate inflection point.
How so?
Well, you had this moment of profound legislative capitulation, finally. But at the same time, you had incredible executive defiance and even national security paralysis all happening at once. It was chaotic.
That's a perfect way to frame it, because we aren't just looking at, you know, the shutdown continuing. We're really examining a total cascading failure across all three branches of government.
Yeah.
And it was fundamentally driven by that political impasse, that six-week standoff. So this deep dive, it really has to deliver a comprehensive report on everything the federal government did, or maybe more importantly, failed to do during this really chaotic window.
It really wasn't a slow burn anymore by this point. It erupted. And our sources, they show four simultaneous, deeply interconnected conflicts that just define those 48 hours.
Right.
If you really want to understand what happens when the federal government truly turns on itself, you need to understand these four flashpoints.
Okay, let's preview those four then, because they really set the framework for our deep dive today. And they show the extraordinary scope of the chaos that, well, you were living through, the listener. First, there was this massive legislative rupture in the Senate. It finally forced a compromise, yes, but it caused some serious internal political damage in the process.
Huge damage, yeah.
Second, an unprecedented administrative war on states. This was the USDA literally trying to claw back food assistance that had already gone out.
Unbelievable, really.
Third, a severe domestic security conflict. We saw aggressive, almost militaristic DHS raids happening in a major American city.
In Chicago, yep.
And fourth, an alarming national security paralysis. This one had global implications, halting critical arms exports to key allies. Just stopped.
And this brings us right away to the central paradox of this whole period. Amidst all the internal chaos, right? Self-inflicted domestic problems, airports melting down, food aid being fought over, federal workers just living in limbo.
Real mess.
Amidst all that, the administration somehow managed to functionally execute one major planned foreign policy pivot, a massive trade detente with China.
So strategic coherence abroad.
While falling apart at home. It's a stark contrast.
Okay, let's unpack this. We need to start where that legislative deadlock finally broke the U.S. Senate, because this was the place where the political pain just got so acute that, what, 14 previous failures were suddenly wiped away by one dramatic Sunday vote.
That's exactly right. Sunday, November 9th. Now, you know, the Senate, they don't usually convene on a weekend.
Right, especially not deep into a protracted shutdown like this one, 40 days in.
Exactly. But the pressure, it had just become, unbearable. The drama really centered on the 15th attempt to get that procedural vote, cloture, you know.
Yeah, the 60-vote threshold to break a filibuster.
Yeah.
Just to even get to a final vote.
Right. And the previous attempts, they were mostly political theater, just forcing opponents on the record. This time, though, the stakes felt existential.
And this time, they finally hit it. But just barely, right?
Yeah.
60-40.
By the absolute bare minimum, yeah.
What's really fascinating here, and the sources really emphasize this, is how it happened. It wasn't the party leaders making a deal.
No, not at all. It was engineered by a bipartisan coalition of moderate senators, people who basically just stood up and said, enough is enough.
A rupture of party discipline, then.
Absolutely. A true moderate coalition that broke ranks. Our sources list eight influential Democrats who crossed over. You had Senators King, Shaheen, Hassan, Durbin, Fetterman, Kaine, Cortez Masto, and Rosen.
That's a significant group.
It is. And they basically chose to prioritize the immediate functional needs of the government. You know, stopping the air travel chaos, dealing with the SNAP crisis over their party's main policy demand in the shutdown fight.
And looking at that list, King, an independent who caucuses with Democrats, but Shaheen, Hassan, Kaine, Cortez Masto, Rosen, many represent states with huge federal worker populations or were facing tough re-elections. Yeah. The pressure on them must have been immense.
Oh, absolutely. Their constituents were feeling the pain daily. People couldn't get paychecks, airports were jammed, vital services were fraying. They reached a point where the cost of continuing the shutdown, politically, economically, socially, was just greater than the cost of giving up that policy goal. They asserted their own power over the party leadership.
So, okay, let's get into the details of what they actually passed, this legislative vehicle. I heard some staff were calling it the Crimidibus.
Yeah, a bit of dark humor there from some Republican staff, apparently. Because it was so rushed, so cobbled together, it was a really unusual structure, actually, a two-pronged funding mechanism.
Okay, break that down for us.
So, first prong, it provided full-year appropriations for fiscal year 2026, but only for three specific highly critical areas.
Which ones?
The Department of Veterans Affairs, which is always politically sensitive. The Department of Agriculture, and this is absolutely key because that funds SNAP, the food stamp program.
Right, the immediate crisis program.
Exactly. Locking in that full year funding for ag showed that the SNAP crisis was probably the primary driver for these moderates making the deal. And the third was the legislative branch itself, basically so Congress could keep functioning.
Okay, so VA, ag, legislative branch funded for the whole year, safe. But what about, well, everything else? Defense, transportation, Homeland Security, State Department.
That's the second prong. And it's much less stable. For all those other agencies, the deal provided only a short-term continuing resolution, or CR.
Just keeping the lights on, basically.
Essentially, yeah. It funds them at their existing fiscal year 2025 levels. But, and this is the crucial part, the CR only runs through January 30th, 2026.
So just a couple of months.
Right. So while it immediately reopens the entire government, which was the goal, it absolutely kicks the can down the road on the bigger budget fight. Most federal agencies, most federal workers, they're going to face another funding cliff very early next year. The tension isn't resolved, it's just postponed.
Okay, now we absolutely have to drill down on that Democratic fracture, because this is where the deal got really painful politically for them. What was the huge concession? The thing that made progressives like Senator Bernie Sanders and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries just furious.
The sticking point, the big give, was abandoning the extension of the expiring Affordable Care Act, the ACA health insurance subsidies.
The subsidies. That was their line in the sand for weeks.
These subsidies were set to expire, and if they did, it meant immediate, significant premium spikes for millions of people. Maybe 20 million Americans on the ACA marketplaces were looking at huge increases, sometimes hundreds of dollars a month.
And for 40 days, Democrats had held the line, saying protecting those subsidies, protecting healthcare access, was worth the shutdown fight.
They did. They argued it was non-negotiable.
Yeah.
And then, with this deal, they folded. They traded that guaranteed extension for the immediate reopening of the government.
And the progressive backlash?
Immediate and fierce. Senator Sanders, who carries a lot of weight, he called the vote a very, very bad vote. Said it prioritized political convenience over the financial security of millions. He really hammered the point that failing to secure this extension guarantees premiums will spike in January.
Right around the time this new CR is set to expire again.
Double whammy.
Yeah. And the resistance wasn't just in the Senate. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, he declared his opposition before the Senate even finished voting. Stated flat out that House Democrats would not support this bill.
So the Senate was basically going rogue, trying to force the House's hand.
Pretty much. The Senate was acting unilaterally to compel action from a House that was paralyzed and frankly hadn't even been in a session consistently. They were trying to break the logjam by themselves.
Was there any concession from Republicans on the ACA subsidies to, you know, maybe soften the blow for those moderate Democrats, give them some cover?
There was something, but the sources describe it as pretty weak. A vague promise is the term used. It came from the Republican leader, John Thune.
Okay, what was the promise? He promised to hold a separate vote on extending the ACA subsidies sometime by the second week of December. But here's the catch. After the government is reopened.
Okay, why is that timing so critical? After it reopens.
Because once the government is back up and running, the Democrats lose their biggest leverage point. They can't credibly threaten another shutdown just 2 weeks later over the ACA subsidies. Thune's promise guaranteed a vote, sure, but it gave absolutely zero guarantee of passage.
So political cover, a fig leaf.
Exactly. Just enough for those moderate Democrats to say, look, we secured a path forward, even if that path was, you know, politically very uncertain. It was just enough to get them over the 60 vote line.
Beyond the politics, let's talk about the federal workers. They were caught in the middle of this for 6 weeks. furloughed, working without pay. What did this criminibus actually do for them?
That was a huge sticking point, especially for senators like Tim Kaine from Virginia, with so many federal employees in his state. The deal included a really crucial provision to protect the workforce. Specifically, it mandated the unwinding, basically banning the planned reduction in force layoffs, the RIFs.
Can you quickly clarify RIF? That sounds worse than a furlough.
Oh, it is. Much worse. A furlough is temporary. You're told not to work. You don't get paid for that time, but you're still an employee. A reduction in force, a RIF, that's essentially a mass layoff. It's a permanent termination of employment, usually due to budget cuts or agency restructuring.
And Trump administration had actually started issuing those.
Yes. They had begun issuing RIF notices targeting thousands of federal workers for permanent termination during the shutdown. This provision in the Senate deal immediately stopped those plans. It guaranteed those targeted workers would keep their jobs.
Okay, that's huge. What about pay?
Also crucial, the deal guaranteed full back pay for every single federal worker who was either furloughed or forced to work without pay during the entire 41-day shutdown. That meant hundreds of thousands of families could finally expect to get the money they were owed.
So, zooming out on this first part, the Senate breakthrough. It was messy. It was a capitulation forced by the sheer chaos, the airport mess, the SNAP crisis. But it did show the Senate at least finally asserting its will over the paralysis.
It absolutely did. This compromise showed that the real negotiating power at this moment had shifted away from the traditional leadership, the Speaker, the President, and towards this bipartisan group of moderates who were feeling the heat from back home. The Senate, being in session, acted unilaterally to basically force the House, which hadn't met properly since September, to come back and pass this thing. It was an act of institutional self-preservation, really.
That sets the stage perfectly for the next crisis. Because while the Senate was maybe forcing a kind of legislative peace on Sunday, the executive branch was simultaneously declaring administrative war on the states, specifically over food aid.
Right. Let's move to that domestic battlefront. This is where things got really, really ugly over that weekend. The battle over SNAP benefits, and tied into that, the DHS enforcement actions.
This part of the deep dive, it feels particularly disturbing. You have the executive branch apparently trying to defy a court order and financially coerce states all over feeding 42 million people.
It is deeply concerning. It involves the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service, FNS. We need to nail down the timeline and the sheer legal contradiction here. Let's talk about the undo directive.
The undo directive, what was that?
So the FNS, reportedly under the direction of Deputy Undersecretary Patrick Penn, issued this incredibly aggressive memo on Saturday, November 9th. The language was just blunt, threatening.
What did it say?
It ordered state SNAP directors to, quote, immediately undo the full November SNAP benefits that had already been lawfully paid out.
Wait, paid out already? How could they undo that?
That's the crux of it. The memo claimed these payments, which had gone out just the day before, were now somehow unauthorized because of a late-breaking legal development.
Okay, this sounds legally messy. How could payments that were already made, already on people's EBT cards, suddenly become unauthorized? You'd have to walk us through the legal mechanics here.
Right. This is where the chaos really lies. Let's track the sequence. Friday morning, November 7th, states like Massachusetts, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Oregon, they issue their full November SNAP key payments. Millions of families get their benefits loaded onto their cards.
And they did this legally.
Yes. Critically, they did so in full compliance with the binding U.S. District Court order from Judge John McConnell. The administration had tried to stop it, but failed to get a legal stay before the payments went out. So at the moment those electronic transfers happened, they were 100% lawful.
Okay. But then something changed late Friday.
Yes. Late Friday, November 7th, Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson issued a temporary administrative stay. This was the administration finally getting a pause from the high court.
What did that stay actually do?
It essentially hit the pause button on the legal process. It halted the legal basis for any new payments after that moment. But, and this is the absolute key point, that stay did not, and legally could not, retroactively cancel or nullify the electronic fund transfers that had already been completed earlier that day.
So the money was already out there.
Yeah.
In people's accounts.
Exactly. Already sitting in the accounts of 42 million families. So when the USDA sent that memo on Saturday, November 9th, demanding states undo the payments, they were essentially ordering states to rewind time, to pull back money that was legally theirs, operationally almost impossible to retrieve and based on a stay that didn't apply retroactively.
And the memo didn't just ask nicely, I assume?
Oh, not at all. It backed up this legally dubious demand with some serious financial threats. They cited a specific federal regulation, 7 CFR 271.7H. This was the hammer.
What does that regulation allow them to do?
It gives the federal government the power to withhold the money states use to actually run the SNFP programs. We're talking funding for state administrative costs, computers, staff salaries, office space, everything needed to manage the program.
So basically, starve the state agencies running the program.
Precisely. For big states, this administrative funding runs into the hundreds of millions of dollars. The USDA memo explicitly threatened the cancellation of the federal share of state administrative costs and warned they would hold states liable for any overissuances, meaning the states would have to somehow repay the feds for the benefits that went out.
Wow. So they were holding the state welfare departments hostage, demanding they act like collection agencies against their own poorest residents.
That's exactly what it looks like. A coercive, punitive measure designed to financially cripple states that had, ironically, just followed a federal court order.
How did the states react, especially the Democratic governors in places like Massachusetts and Wisconsin, who were directly targeted?
With open defiance. And they framed it in constitutional terms. Governor Maura Healey of Massachusetts was incredibly firm right out of the gate. She told SNFP recipients, go ahead, spend the benefits. And she said, quote, if President Trump wants to penalize states for preventing Americans from going hungry, we will see him in court. We will not take food out of the mouths of Massachusetts residents.
Strong words. What about Wisconsin?
Governor Tony Evers in Wisconsin, where nearly 700,000 people had received the full payment, his response to the USDA memo was even simpler. Just one word. No.
No.
Mm.
But this brings up the practical question you mentioned. Even if they wanted to comply, could the states actually recall that money electronically?
State officials basically said, no, this is punitive, not practical. The EBT system, the electronic benefit transfer system, it's designed to deposit funds, not to withdraw them retroactively from active accounts, especially when people might have already spent some of the money on, you know, groceries.
Right.
The Minnesota Department of Children, Youth, and Families put it very plainly. They said they, quote, do not have any mechanism for taking money back from SNAT recipients. End of story.
So the states were caught, defy the president's USDA, or somehow find hundreds of millions in their own state budgets to cover these supposed overissuances.
An impossible position. And we actually saw Hawaii announce they would use state emergency funds, something called HEFAP, to cover the federal failure, essentially forcing Hawaiian taxpayers to pick up the tab for the federal government's breakdown.
It's just stunning that this administrative war against the states over food aid was happening on the exact same day the Senate was voting to fully fund the USDA to resolve the SNAP crisis legislatively. The disconnect is jarring.
It really reveals how the shutdown is being used, doesn't it? It wasn't just passive failure. It was an active opportunity for political enforcement by the executive branch. They were leveraging the crisis to exert maximum pressure on perceived political enemies, blue states, in this case, regardless of what Congress was doing. The legislative fix seemed almost secondary to the administrative warfare.
Okay, let's pivot now to the second major domestic security flashpoint that erupted over that same weekend, the DHS enforcement raid in Chicago.
Right. This incident happened in Chicago's Little Village neighborhood, also on Saturday, November 9th. And it was immediately characterized by, well, a very overt militaristic presence and conflict with local authorities and the community.
What made it seem militaristic?
The sources describe the agents likely from an elite federal tactical unit, maybe CBP's BORTAC or BORSTAR, showing up in standardized camouflage uniforms, full masks, carrying military-style weapons. It created an immediate atmosphere of confrontation in a dense urban neighborhood.
What was the official federal justification for this kind of heavy presence?
Well, DHS put out a press release that really fit the administration's ongoing war zone rhetoric about cities. The headline itself was inflammatory. Border patrol agents face shots fired, vehicle rammings, bricks thrown in Chicago.
Wow, so they claimed they were under attack.
Yes, the official story was that they were there conducting a necessary operation to arrest violent, criminal, illegal aliens, and that they immediately faced violent resistance, including shots being fired at them.
But local officials disputed that narrative almost immediately, didn't they?
They did. It created a direct conflict of facts right on the ground. The Chicago Police Department spokesperson put out a statement saying, quote, no one was injured in the shooting reported by federal agents. which strongly suggests the only shots fired might have been by the federal agents.
Mm.
And then you had the local alderman, Byron Cico Lopez, who reported that it was the federal agents who escalated things by firing chemical agents at the crowd that flocked to the scene to protest.
Okay, chemical agents. This brings us to the most disturbing specific incident from that raid, the one involving the Verrazzo family.
Yeah, this is where the legal questions and the human cost really collide. Rafael Verrazza, a 25-year-old father, was reportedly just driving nearby with his wife and their one-year-old daughter, who was strapped in a car seat. They were completely unconnected to the raid or the protests.
Just driving by?
Just driving by. An armed federal agent allegedly walked up to their car and sprayed a chemical irritant pepper spray directly into the open car window.
Into the car? With a baby inside?
Yes. Both Mr. Verrazza, who apparently suffers from asthma, and his infant daughter had to be hospitalized afterward because of severe exposure to the chemical agent.
That's horrifying. Beyond just the awful human impact, what does that specific action, spraying pepper spray into a car with a child, suggest about how the executive branch was operating during this crisis?
Well, it strongly suggests an apparent and possibly deliberate defiance of the judicial branch, because the use of chemical irritants on non-threatening civilians, like a family in a car, appeared to be in direct violation of a recent U.S. District Court order.
There was a court order about this?
Yes, issued by Judge Sarah Ellis. That order specifically prohibited federal agents from using riot control weapons, including chemical irritants, to disperse crowds if there was a risk of injuring anyone who was not causing an immediate threat of physical harm. Spraying pepper spray into a car with a baby seems, well, hard to justify under that standard.
So we're seeing a pattern emerge here over just these 2 days. The executive branch seemingly pushing back against, or maybe even ignoring, judicial limits. You had the USDA memo effectively defying the district court on SNAP payments.
Right.
And now DHS agents in Chicago apparently defying a different district court order on their enforcement tactics.
It's a really key theme of these 48 hours. You have parts of the central government seemingly at war with its own checks and balances, judicial rulings, state authority. By officially framing the Chicago scene as a combat situation, a war zone, in their press release, DHS essentially gave themselves post hoc justification for using those chemical agents indiscriminately. It reinforced the administration's political narrative and created a kind of permission structure for really aggressive, maybe unconstrained behavior, regardless of court orders or what local police were reporting.
Okay, let's shift gears now to the crisis that probably touched the most Americans directly over that weekend. The meltdown in air travel, and the growing warnings about the broader economy.
Yeah, the air travel system really hit a breaking point. System failure is not too strong a word. On Sunday alone, the numbers were just staggering. Over 10,000 flight delays nationwide and more than 4,000 outright cancellations.
Wow.
Major hubs, Newark, Atlanta, Chicago O'Hare, San Francisco, they were just gridlocked. Total chaos. Delta Airlines apparently told its staff that flights faced, and this is their quote, a 50-50 chance of a full meltdown.
And the root cause, obviously, the shutdown, critical staff working without pay for weeks. But it wasn't just about money, right? It was about safety staffing levels.
Absolutely. Air traffic controllers, TSA screeners, they were deemed essential, so they had to show up. But working without pay for over a month, the stress, the fatigue, mandatory rest periods kicking in because people were working extra shifts, it just started decimating the workforce numbers available at any given time.
And this wasn't something that would just snap back to normal once the shutdown ended, right?
No, and that was the warning from Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy. He pointed out this crisis would have long-term consequences. He revealed some grim statistics. The FAA was seeing 15 to 20 experienced air traffic controllers retiring every single day during the shutdown.
15 to 20 a day.
Mm-hmm.
What's normal?
Normal pre-shutdown was maybe 4 a day, so it was a huge spike in attrition. And Secretary Duffy warned that this staffing crisis, it will live on long after the funding comes back.
Because you can't just hire controllers off the street.
Not even close. It takes years, often 3 to 5 years, to train a controller from scratch to be fully certified for a complex tower or sector. Losing 15 or 20 experienced people daily creates a massive hole in the training pipeline that's going to impact flight capacity and potentially cause delays for years to come.
And because they didn't have enough staff, the FAA actually had to order airlines to cut flights just to maintain basic safety.
Yeah, the mandated cuts were escalating quickly. They started Friday with a 4% cut across 40 major airports, but the schedule was brutal. 6% cuts by Monday the 11th, 8% by Wednesday the 13th and 10% by Friday the 14th.
A 10% cut across the board.
Yes. And Secretary Duffy warned on Sunday that if the shutdown continued much longer, air travel would be, quote, reduced to a trickle before Thanksgiving, meaning a huge number of Americans just wouldn't be able to fly for the holiday.
And these weren't just abstract numbers.
Yeah.
The sources really brought home the human cost with some specific stories.
They did. Really heartbreaking anecdotes. There was a Canadian couple stuck for 3 whole days, burning through vacation money on hotels because they couldn't get any flight out of the New York area.
Hmm.
And the story of a father and son who missed celebrating their mother and grandmother's 98th birthday because their quick trip got canceled with no warning.
Just awful.
These personal stories, combined with the images we all saw, endless lines, terminals overflowing with stranded people, it really paints a picture of total system failure. As one passenger put it, they shut down the entire country, not just the government.
And beyond the traveler's nightmare, the Treasury Department chimed in with a pretty stark warning about the wider economic impact, right? Especially with the holidays approaching.
Yeah. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent issued a serious warning. He said the flight slowdowns weren't just hurting passengers, they were hitting air cargo hard. That threatened supply chain disruptions and potential shortages of goods right as the critical holiday shopping and shipping season was supposed to be ramping up.
And the overall economy.
Bessent was blunt. He warned that if the shutdown dragged on into the next week, the economic growth for the fourth quarter of the final 3 months of the year could be cut by as much as half.
Half? That's huge. Billions of dollars in lost activity.
Potentially, yes. Lost productivity, lost sales. A major blow to the economy right at year's end.
Okay, so against this backdrop of economic anxiety, and also remember, following some recent Democratic wins in elections where cost of living was a big issue, President Trump announced a new affordability proposal on Sunday.
Yeah, the announcement came via social media, as often happens. The president floated the idea of a tariff dividend.
Tariff dividend? What's
that? He proposed that most Americans, specifically excluding high-income people, would receive at least $2,000. And this money, this dividend, would be financed entirely by the revenue collected from tariffs imposed earlier, mostly on Chinese goods. The Treasury reported that tariff collection was about $195 billion so far that year.
So using tariff money to send checks to people, essentially bypassing Congress and traditional spending programs.
That seems to be the idea. It fits a pattern of trying to address affordability concerns with direct payments or tax cuts, rather than subsidies or regulations. Secretary Bessent later clarified it might not be a simple check, though. It could take the form of specific tax cuts, maybe removing taxes on tips or overtime pay or even Social Security benefits, or making auto loan interest deductible, things designed to put cash or tax relief back in people's pockets quickly.
And there was another affordability idea floated around the same time, this one about housing, and it sounded pretty radical, the 50-year mortgage.
Yeah, that one definitely raised eyebrows. The idea of a 50-year mortgage term instead of the standard 30 years. The goal, politically, is clear. Lower the monthly payment. By stretching the loan out over 50 years, the principal part of the payment gets much smaller each month, making home ownership seem more affordable on a month-to-month basis.
But the catch must be huge.
Oh, it's massive. The trade-off is the total interest paid over the life of the loan. It would be exponentially higher. You could end up paying double or even triple the original price of the house in interest over those 50 years. It locks homeowners into debt for half a century. It's a classic example of trying to fix an immediate political problem, high monthly costs potentially, by creating a much bigger long-term systemic debt risk.
Okay. So we painted a picture of the domestic situation. Legislative breakthrough, born of desperation, administrative warfare, economic decay, travel chaos. A real mess. But now, part four of our deep dive gets into that jarring counter-narrative. Foreign policy moving forward with surprising coherence. Let's start, though, by contrasting that with the national security paralysis caused by the shutdown.
Right. This is the failure that had immediate, tangible geopolitical consequences. On November 9th, reports finally confirmed that over $5 billion with a B in critical U.S. weapons exports were stuck, delayed.
$5 billion worth.
Yeah.
And this wasn't a policy decision to hold them back.
No, that's the key. It wasn't a strategic choice by the White House to stop these sales. It was purely a procedural bureaucratic failure caused directly by the shutdown furloughs. Stuff just wasn't getting signed.
Can you give us specifics? Which allies were affected and what kind of weapons are we talking about?
We're talking about really crucial, sophisticated systems that are central to U.S. security partnerships. Things like the HIMARS rocket launchers, vital in Ukraine.
Yay.
Amran air-to-air missiles, the complex Aegis naval combat systems.
And who was supposed to get them?
Key NATO allies like Poland, Denmark, and Croatia. Countries on the front lines, really, relying on U.S. supply chains to maintain their military readiness. And of course, Ukraine itself, whose ability to keep fighting depended heavily on these kinds of resupplies. The Institute for the Study of War flagged it immediately as having a real impact on the battlefield dynamics there.
So what was the specific bureaucratic hang-up? Who was furloughed that could stop $5 billion in weapons?
It comes down to the Arms Export Control Act. Under that law, the State Department has to formally notify Congress about proposed major foreign military sales. It's a standard procedure.
Yeah.
That notification process is handled by non-political career staff in the State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs. Because those specific staffers were deemed non-essential during the shutdown and sent home, the notifications simply couldn't be processed. Paperwork didn't get filed, and that created an instant bottleneck, holding up this huge amount of critical defense equipment.
So it raises the question, if the administration, maybe quietly, wanted to slow down aid, particularly to Ukraine, aligning with their America First rhetoric, was the shutdown actually a convenient, passive way to achieve that goal without having to issue an unpopular order?
That's exactly the analysis offered in the sources. It's described as a soft veto. You hit the nail on the head. The administration's stated policy was shifting towards negotiated peace, curbing new military aid. By allowing the domestic budget fight the fight over ACA subsidies, fundamentally to paralyze the procedural staff at the State Department. The White House effectively got a de facto pause on $5 billion of previously approved aid.
Without taking the political heat for overtly blocking it.
Exactly. They avoided the potentially huge political blowback, especially from NATO allies, that would have come from an explicit executive order halting the aid. Instead, they let this bureaucratic failure caused by the internal DC squabble do the dirty work for them. It was passive policy execution, but with massive geopolitical ripple effects.
That analysis really throws the contradiction into sharp relief. The government couldn't get a form signed to send missiles to Poland. But at the exact same time, it was executing a major, complex, strategic geopolitical maneuver. The U.S.-China trade detente, which formally took effect on Monday, November 10th.
The contrast is just jarring, isn't it? The implementation of this China deal shows exactly where the administration's real strategic focus was and which functions they made sure were protected, wind-fenced from the domestic chaos. On November 10th, the U.S. Trade Representative, USTR, formally enacted a one-year suspension of the Section 301 tariffs that specifically targeted China's maritime logistics and shipbuilding sectors.
Wait, I remember those maritime tariffs. Weren't they just imposed like a month earlier in October, part of a big push to counter China's industrial dominance in shipbuilding?
They were. Very recent. And yes, they were billed as a key part of the restoring maritime dominance agenda.
Why suddenly sacrifice that? What was the quid pro quo from China? What did the U.S. get in return for dropping those brand new tariffs?
It was a very clear, very strategic trade-off. The administration essentially sacrificed that specific domestic industrial policy goal to secure two immediate and arguably more critical national security concessions from Beijing, concessions they hadn't been able to get for months.
Okay, what were they?
First, China committed to finally halting the flow of fentanyl precursor chemicals into North America, a huge issue, a public health crisis fueling the opioid epidemic. That was a major deliverable.
Right. And the second?
Second, and maybe even more vital from a strategic tech perspective, China agreed to suspend its new export controls on critical rare earth elements, specifically gallium, germanium, and graphite. And they issued general licenses allowing U.S. companies to access them.
Wow. Securing rare earth supply is huge, given China's stranglehold on that market.
Absolutely critical. China controls something like 90% of the world's processing capacity for these elements, which are essential for everything from advanced electronics to defense systems. Locking down that supply chain for U.S. tech and military manufacturing was clearly deemed paramount. It immediately trumped the goal of trying to nurture a domestic shipbuilding industry via tariffs. It was a calculated sacrifice, even though it directly contradicted the president's own recent executive order on maritime dominance.
And that sacrifice, dropping the maritime tariffs, must have caused an immediate backlash from the U.S. shipbuilding industry and unions, right? Mm. The very people those tariffs were supposed to help.
Instantaneous and fierce, U.S. shipbuilding unions, according to the sources, blasted the White House. They called the suspension a betrayal. They argued it didn't just kill off potential U.S. industrial growth in that sector, but it also eliminated a potential funding stream that was supposed to go into a maritime security trust fund. It really highlights that painful political choice. Sacrifice a relatively narrow domestic industry for broader geopolitical stability and critical supply chain security.
But while the shipbuilders were furious, there was broad support from other, much larger parts of the economy, wasn't there? Which probably explains the political calculation.
Oh, definitely. The reaction tells the story. Global retailers, who rely heavily on Chinese shipping and logistics, they were thrilled. The American Petroleum Institute, representing the energy sector, they applauded it. And crucially, massive agricultural interests, the soybean farmers, the pork producers, the corn growers, they were huge winners.
Why agriculture?
Because as part of this whole package deal, China simultaneously suspended its retaliatory tariffs on those key U.S. agricultural exports. So the administration clearly prioritized the interests of the powerful import-export economy, agriculture, and immediate national security needs, fentanyl, rare earths, over the longer-term politically harder task of protecting domestic shipbuilders.
Okay, the foreign policy coherence didn't stop with China, though. That same Monday, November 10th, was scheduled to be another historic day, a high-stakes meeting marking a potential massive strategic shift in the Middle East.
Yes, the first ever visit of a Syrian leader to the White House. President Trump was scheduled to meet with Syria's transitional president, Ahmed al-Sharaa.
Al-Sharaa, he led the offensive that finally overthrew the Assad regime, right?
That's correct. He's now leading Syria's transitional government. And his presence in the Oval Office would signal a dramatic shift, Syria potentially reemerging from decades as a pariah state.
What groundwork did the U.S. lay to make this visit even possible? There must have been symbolic steps.
There were. The State Department had recently taken al-Sharaa himself and his interior minister, Anas Hassan Kattab, off the specially designated global terrorist list. That was seen as the essential first step.
And that paves the way for
it. It's seen as the necessary precursor to eventually removing Syria entirely from the state sponsors of terrorism list. That designation has been in place for over 40 years, and the speculation was it could be officially lifted as soon as December.
So what are the big strategic goals for the U.S. here? Why this sudden, dramatic rapprochement with post-Assad Syria? It can't just be about wanting stability there.
The goals are definitely multifaceted and mostly focused on regional power dynamics. The primary objective seems to be using a new Syrian government as a strategic counterweight to Iran's influence in the region, specifically hoping Syria will cut off the weapons and logistics routes that Iran uses to supply Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Okay, countering Iran. What else?
A secondary but really crucial goal is to eventually bring Syria into the Abraham Accords framework. That would mean normalized ties between Syria and Israel, a truly seismic shift in the region.
Wow.
And critically, during this visit, al-Sharaa was expected to make a major announcement that Syria would formally join the international coalition that's still working to defeat the remnants of the Islamic State group ISIS, which continues to be a threat in parts of Syria and Iraq.
So, a lot riding on that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've covered the legislative drama, the administrative battles, the economic fallout, the foreign policy paradox. Lastly, we need to cover this flurry of other high-stakes, politically charged actions that happened late Sunday night into Monday morning, kind of under the cover of all the other chaos.
You frame that perfectly, because this is when some of the most politically volatile moves of the whole 48-hour period occurred. First, and maybe foremost, the presidential pardons.
Ah, yes. The pardons, what happened there?
Late Sunday night, the U.S. Pardon Attorney's Office announced that President Trump had granted sweeping pardons to his former personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani.
Giuliani pardoned? But it wasn't just him, right? The sources mentioned a whole slate of others.
A massive slate. It seemed aimed at covering pretty much all the key figures who were facing federal charges or potential charges related to the efforts to overturn the 2020 election.
Who else was on that list?
Besides Giuliani, it included former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, attorneys Sidney Powell, Kenneth Cheeseborough, Jeffrey Clark, and John Eastman, political operative Boris Epstein, several others. It was comprehensive.
And the justification given?
The official proclamation apparently stated the pardons were meant to, quote, end a grave national injustice. And it specifically noted these pardons apply only to federal offenses. They wouldn't cover any state charges these individuals might face, and, importantly, didn't apply to the president himself.
The timing, though. Late Sunday night, while everyone's focused on the shutdown deal finally breaking, the airports being a mess. That seems very deliberate.
Oh, absolutely. Release it when public attention is fractured and elsewhere. It maximized the distraction factor, allowed them to execute this incredibly politically explosive action with minimal immediate media focus or public outcry. It also effectively slammed the door shut on any potential future federal cooperation these individuals might have offered investigators regarding the 2020 events. It essentially tied up the federal loose ends for that inner circle.
And at the same time, there were these whistleblower documents emerging about Ghislaine Maxwell, the convicted sex offender, suggesting some kind of unusual treatment.
Yes, that was another strange story breaking around the same time. Documents provided by a whistleblower, reportedly to Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee, showed two things. First, that Ghislaine Maxwell was actively seeking a commutation of her sentence from President Trump.
Okay, seeking commutation isn't that unusual, maybe. What else?
The really explosive part was the allegation that she'd been receiving, quote, concierge-style treatment ever since she was transferred to a lower-security prison down in Texas. And that transfer happened right after she reportedly had a meeting with the deputy attorney general.
Concierge-style treatment. What does that even mean in a prison context? It sounds like serious preferential treatment.
The details described in the documents are pretty stunning, if true. It allegedly included things like getting custom meals delivered personally to her cell, having a special cordoned-off area set up just for her visitors, complete with snacks and refreshments. Her visitors were even allowed to bring in computers, which is apparently highly unusual. And she was supposedly being routinely escorted for solo gym time outside of the normal schedule for other inmates.
Wow.
The level of alleged favoritism was so blatant that one Bureau of Prisons official was quoted in the documents complaining that they were, quote, sick of having to be Maxwell's bee.
Unbelievable. And that immediately got a reaction from Congress.
Yes. Representative Jamie Raskin, a high-ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, jumped on it. He blasted what he called the outlandishly favorable treatment. He suggested it strongly implied that Maxwell either still holds tremendous sway over powerful people, or maybe that she was agreeing to suppress information related to other high-profile individuals or investigations in exchange for this treatment. He formally demanded testimony from the Deputy Attorney General to explain why a convicted high-profile sex offender was apparently being treated like an honored guest in federal prison.
Okay. Moving away from the political firestorms for a moment, there was also critical public health action from the FDA over the weekend, right? Regarding baby formula.
Yes. Amidst everything else, the FDA had to act fast. They announced late Sunday night that they were launching an urgent investigation into 13 reported cases of infant botulism. Infant botulism. That's serious.
Extremely serious. Life-threatening for infants. These cases were spread across 10 different states and appeared potentially linked to specific batches of ByHeart powdered infant formula.
So what happened?
It led the manufacturer, ByHeart, to issue an immediate voluntary recall for two specific batches of their whole nutrition infant formula. They gave the batch codes 251261P2 and 251131P2 and urged any consumers who had them to discard them right away. It's a reminder that even when the government seems paralyzed by politics, some core public health functions still have to happen, and fast.
Definitely. And finally, there was a pretty big story breaking in the sports world that actually involved federal law enforcement making arrests during all this.
Yeah, kind of flew under the radar with everything else going on. But a federal indictment was unsealed in New York. It charged two pitchers from the Cleveland Guardians baseball team, Emmanuel Class, their star closer, and Luis Ortiz.
What were they charged with?
Wire fraud, conspiracy, money laundering, and conspiracy to influence sporting contests. Pretty serious stuff.
Influencing games?
The core allegation is that these two pitchers were feeding inside information to co-conspirators who were placing bets. Specifically, information about what pitch they were about to throw, the speed, the type, maybe even the outcome. The indictment alleges the bettors used this real-time info to win at least $460,000.
Wow. So basically fixing pitches for gambling purposes.
That's the allegation. Ortiz was actually arrested in Boston on Sunday, showing federal law enforcement was still operating despite the shutdown chaos. Class, the bigger star, was reportedly not in U.S. custody at that point. It really highlights the growing threat of sophisticated betting schemes targeting professional sports integrity.
Okay. That is just an overwhelming amount of chaos, contradiction, and high-stakes action packed into just 48 hours. Let's try to pull this all together now. What's the big picture? What's the overarching analysis of what these events on November 9th and 10th really tell us about the state of the U.S. government at that moment?
I think what these events demonstrate most clearly is that the government shutdown wasn't some kind of uniform paralysis affecting everything equally. It wasn't just that the lights were off everywhere. Instead, it acted more like a selective filter for the administration's political and strategic priorities.
And you mean a selective filter?
Well, functions that were deemed politically essential or maybe politically advantageous, they continued, sometimes with even more intensity. Think about it. Granting those sweeping pardons, conducting the aggressive DHS raids to fit a political narrative, issuing those threatening financial directives from the USDA against political opponents, executing that complex, high-stakes trade deal with China. Those things happened with high operational tempo, full focus, seemingly unaffected by the shutdown chaos around them.
Right. Those things got done. But the routine, maybe boring, but crucial functions of government, the things that actually protect citizens day to day or maintain global stability, those were the things that got stuck or actively resisted or just deemed expendable.
Exactly. Feeding 42 million Americans who were legally entitled to benefits, that was fought tooth and nail. Processing $5 billion in arms sales to key NATO allies, that ground to a halt over paperwork. Maintaining full staffing for the nation's air traffic control system to prevent travel chaos, that failed spectacularly. Adhering to judicial rulings about how federal agents should operate, that seemed optional. It really reveals a government that was, in many ways, effectively at war with itself.
Executive versus judicial.
Federal versus state governors.
Moderate legislators versus their own party leaders.
All happening simultaneously. Self-inflicted crises layered on top of each other.
And we keep coming back to that central paradox you mentioned at the start. This deep domestic paralysis somehow coexisting with, maybe even facilitating, strategic foreign policy success.
That contrast really is the core story of these 48 hours. The administration proved it was perfectly capable of complex multi-agency coordination when something was a top strategic priority. The USTR rolling out that China trade deal flawlessly is the prime example.
And that deal itself involved a sacrifice dropping the maritime tariffs.
Right. It showed a willingness to jettison a stated domestic industrial policy goal to achieve what were clearly seen as more immediate, more critical national security objectives. Mm-hmm. Getting those rare earth supply lines secured and getting China to act on fentanyl precursors. That was the priority. Domestic shipbuilding could wait.
So if we step all the way back and ask the ultimate question, who won? Who actually benefited the most from all this American domestic chaos, this self-inflicted paralysis over that weekend?
Well, the immediate beneficiaries seemed pretty clear, and they weren't domestic. They were largely external rivals and trading partners. Beijing walked away with a major trade truce, got relief from tariffs, and secured those crucial supply chain concessions, all by basically agreeing to stop sending fentanyl chemicals. And they got this while the U.S. government was tearing itself apart internally.
And the other winner?
Moscow. Russia benefited directly and immediately from the paralysis that halted that $5 billion in critical weapon systems heading to Ukraine and to frontline NATO allies like Poland and Denmark. The shutdown proved, in real time, that America's fundamental ability to arm and reassure its allies is now explicitly vulnerable. Vulnerable to internal DC political squabbles. Vulnerable to bureaucratic inertia caused by domestic fights that have nothing to do with national security strategy.
Which brings us perfectly to our final provocative thought for you, the listener, to chew on after this deep dive. We've seen how a domestic legislative fight in this case, fundamentally about healthcare subsidies, could instantly translate into major international policy failure, halting billions in arms sales because a few clerks were furloughed. So the question is, in a political world where that link is now so brutally clear, what non-legislative, maybe operational or structural measures should the U.S. government prioritize to try and insulate its critical national security functions, its vital supply chains, from the seemingly inevitable disruptions caused by internal political dysfunction and gridlock?